Out here in San Francisco, in Silicon Valley, there's this almost palpable sense of excitement surrounding the space industry right now, and that is incredible and important. We haven't put a man on the moon since 1972. That's 45 years. Where 45 years ago, we were told that we'd be waking up on different worlds by now. A decade ago, people thought it was silly when you talked about Mars or crazy. And today, it's almost part of our identity again. People are excited because the rocket launches we're watching don't just represent the space industry. They represent a new kind of space industry. They represent private citizens building industry at the frontier of human accomplishment and discovery, and advances in technology absolutely critical to moving people through Roddenberry's final frontier.
Space.
But the cool thing about Mars isn't just the way we're getting there. It's why we're going. It's what we're doing once we arrive. We're building a new world. And today, we're going to talk about why we must. I'm Mike Solana, and you're listening to Anatomy of Next.
Are human beings creators or destroyers?
We're kind of stuck in this incremental cycle.
The alternative is to become a space-faring civilization and a multi-planet species. I mean, first of all, why go anywhere, right?
That's Elon Musk speaking at last year's International Astronautical Congress in Guadalajara, Mexico. And he's asking really the fundamental question, why are we doing this?
I think there are really two fundamental paths. History is going to bifurcate along two directions. One path is we stay on Earth forever, and then there will be some eventual extinction event. I don't have an immediate doomsday prophecy, but it's eventually, history suggests there will be some doomsday event. The alternative is to become a space-faring civilization and a multi-planet species, which I hope you would agree that is the right way to go. Yes?
Mars is a topic that comes up at Founders Fund quite a lot. So I asked a few folks around the office, you know, why do we have to go? Why is this so important? Talk to John Luddick first.
John, you're the youngest member of the team, and some would say the hope for the future. Why would you say we must go to Mars?
To de-risk the single point of failure for human civilization, which is Earth.
He sort of tentatively answers with what has become a fairly common, and I think pretty reasonable take. Is it Scott Nolan?
There's no limit to the number of existential threats we face. If we don't go to Mars, we know with 100% certainty that at some point, human life will end entirely.
And Trey agreed as well. But Trey also brought us to the sort of immaterial extreme. On the other side of practical, there's idealistic.
Yeah, I'm really inspired by kind of the high-level narratives that you hear from people like Elon and others that are engaged in the space that, you know, it's important to have a plan B. We need a backup. We need some jumping off point for our civilization into being a multiplanetary or potentially an interstellar species. That all makes sense to me. But really the thing that's motivating to me is that I grew up in a home where my parents constantly talked about the moon landing. You know, I'm from the hometown of Neil Armstrong, and that was kind of a pivotal moment in my parents' life. And I feel like our generation doesn't have a moon landing. You know, in order to inspire the next generation, I think we need to do things that bring us together as a people and drive us to do greater and greater things.
Siam Bannister kind of rejected the question.
Well, it's inevitable that, in my opinion, that we'll become an interplanetary species, right? And so if we're going to do that, you know, Mars might not be the ultimate end destination, but we've got to figure out how to get off this planet and go someplace else. And how to be fit. And by fit, I mean, how do we have to modify ourselves, our bodies, in order to actually survive space, to survive Mars? And, you know, I think it's the closest planet near to us that we can actually accomplish this with. So we have to try. Like, we need to try.
Why Mars assumes it's an open question. But for Cyan, it seems settled. The question then is not why Mars, but how do we prepare? Zach kind of continued down this path.
It's this almost like final frontier that taps into this like primal nature for us to explore in some way. If you believe in us as a species, at some point in time, we have to become interplanetary, and this is the moment.
Yeah, but why is it important for us
to go into the stars and populate new worlds at all.
I'm always confused when people ask questions like, why not? Like, we spend all this time day trading and looking down when in reality, we should be like looking up. Clearly, we have the potential. We can do it. All signs point to this as a solvable engineering problem. This is within our grasp. Why aren't we doing this?
And this is the real question, right? The exploration and colonization of space does occupy a special place in our culture, where most of the really radical technologies, you know, from general artificial intelligence to genetic engineering, are seen in a pretty unjustly negative light. Many of us look to the space industry for inspiration and for hope. But as we discussed last week, we've had the technology to go to Mars since at least the 70s. So why haven't we gone? This is why I think we need a real defense of Mars as a goal that even matters. I want you to think back to that first argument for Mars. Elon talked about the end of the world. That means we need a contingency plan to ensure our survival. But for this to matter, you have to believe that the human race deserves to survive. And I know this sounds kind of weird, like we have this assumption that we all want this. We have a survival instinct. We kind of blithely assume that we project that instinct outward onto the entire species, but I don't know that we do. And I certainly don't think that our actions indicate anything of the sort.
The fundamental question is this: are human beings creators or destroyers? Do we create resources? Do we destroy resources? Are you better off because there are 7 billion people in the world, or would you be better off if there were much fewer?
It's here I want to argue that resistance to the exploration and subsequent colonization of Mars is rooted in something called anti-humanism. I want to talk about another work of Dr. Robert Zubrin's. Last week, we talked about The Case for Mars. This week, The Merchants of Despair. I know this may at first seem a little too abstract of a place to begin our conversation, but I just don't think it's worth hammering down every wrong opinion on our aspirations in space one by one like a whack-a-mole. Let's get to the root. Do you believe humanity is fundamentally limited, destined to rationing fixed material to a growing population on a single, increasingly hostile world, or is imagination our only limitation? Is the concept of fixed resources, in fact, disproven time and again throughout history? In a very important way, none of this is really about Mars. Here, Mars becomes the proof of a counterargument to the dystopian Malthusian myth of humanity's limited future, a myth that has already manifested with deadly consequences here on Earth this whole past century. I think we're better than this. Today, we start the work of proving it. Dr. Zubrin was in an airport trying to catch a flight when I called him on Skype, so apologies in advance for the weird background noise.
The battle between these two viewpoints is decisive for human history. The expansion of the anti-human viewpoint was responsible for most of the major human-caused catastrophes of the past two centuries and threaten human civilization in the 21st century.
Of course, Zubrin is talking here about Nazism and the political purges of the Soviets, the famines of communist China, and earlier, both world wars. Also, certainly the Indian famines, kind of predecessor to the horrors that we'd see in the brutality of the concentration camps of the 20th century.
In the 1870s were gigantic famines in India. I mean, incredible famines that were caused by exploitation. And by then there was photography and you could look at the people starving and they looked like pictures of Auschwitz, living skeletons. And Florence Nightingale went to the British governor, who had been himself personally a student of Malthus. And she said, look, you have to lift these taxes. These people are starving. And he said, no, if we did that, then they would just multiply more and there'd be even more of them starving.
Always the argument is, if there's not enough to go around, right? If resources are limited, then is there really some justification for hurting other people? Do the ends justify the means? This is the clarion call for evil.
Anti-humanism is closely linked to tribalism. That is that other people are the enemy. In fact, they're not even people. Distilled essence of this in our time, of course, is Nazism, which could be described politely as national social Darwinism. That is the belief that all nations are enemies of each other, and it's a question of survival of the fittest among nations and races, and we should try to exterminate or enslave those others. Putting aside the fact that it was reprehensible, it was scientifically wrong, okay? It was scientifically nuts. Germany today has much less territory than it had under the Third Reich and a larger population and a far higher standard of living. Why? Because wealth doesn't come from land. Wealth comes from people.
And the amount of wealth that people can produce is multiplied by technological progress.
If you believe in the concept of finite resources, in fixed limits to human potential, then we are all people are natural enemies. But on the other hand, if you believe humans are responsible for creating resources, or at least can create resources, right? Let's just start there. The situation is totally different.
That it is free nation is, in a fundamental sense, at least the potential friend of every other nation, every race of every race, and every new person born into the world is a gift. And the fundamental critical goal of government must not be to suppress liberty, but to protect it at all costs, because it is through human freedom that inventions are created.
But that is not, and certainly not intellectually, the world we live in. We don't see an abundance of people as a solution to anything. We see our swelling population as a problem. Thinking like this extends naturally to population suppression, not to building a new world on Mars. If you think of people as a problem, how could your focus ever really be on preventing calamity? Now, you might be thinking something along the lines of, well, it's not a healthy population I have a problem with, it's overpopulation. But what is overpopulation? 100 years ago, we'd never have had the resources to feed over 7 billion people. But today, with those 7 billion people, global hunger is lower than it's ever been. We kind of keep circling around the guy responsible for a lot of our weird population ideas. Ideas that inform everything we do. So I brought Alex Silverman back in. We talked about Thomas Malthus.
Malthus believes that given abundant resources, population will grow. And it'll grow exponentially.
Yeah, this is, I remember I was in college once and the professors were, there was this one professor, he had this kind of real problem with population and people. He's one of these, I think Zubrin would say, anti-humanists. But he gave us this analogy that takes place, it's sort of set in a lily pond. You know, cool. you're in a lily pond, you start with one lily pad. Every single day, the lily pad population doubles. So one becomes two, day two, two becomes four, day three, four becomes eight. And there is a point at which the lily pond will be overpopulated. We'll have so many lily pads in it that there's a mass starvation and all the lily pads die. And then the professor asks, so when was the pond half as full? The day before.
Oh, right. Because of exponential growth. Right. So you don't know. So it's surprising. And yeah. What class was that?
I think it was just like a history class. That's, I mean, all of our professors were pretty left wing. Like they were always finding ways to work this shit in there.
Super intense. Get them while they're young. So it's unclear if Malthus himself actually believed this, but the end game for the Malthusian school of thought on population growth is called the Malthusian catastrophe. Our population just completely exceeds our ability to produce resources, food for ourselves, and we see starvation, we see widespread economic blight, moral vice, and just a world of misery. And it's a really dark and endgame scenario.
But what evidence do we have to prove his theories true? It has become totally commonplace for your kind of armchair philosopher to talk about the dangers of overpopulation as if it's just certain. The more people we have, the less resources we have, the closer we will come to some kind of lily pond extinction event. But all you have to do is look at what's happened, and you'll see our situation supports a kind of exactly opposite take.
As the population of the world has gone up, the standard of living has gone up. Malthus is the most counterfactual philosopher or scientist, if you want to call him that, that has ever been. When Malthus wrote his book in 1800, the world had 1 billion people, and the average global per capita income in today's money was $180 a year. Everything he said is spectacularly wrong. Okay, today there's 7 billion people in the world, and the average per capita income is $9,000. That's 50 times what it was at Malthus's time. So the population has gone up 7 times. The per capita income has gone up 50 times, which is close to 7 squared. And the total income has gone up 350 times, which is 7 cubed. So not only does product go up faster than population, it has gone up as population cubed.
And yet still, for whatever reason, these ideas persist. Population doomsday scenarios are presented. They have been debunked by every single generation since Malthus, and we just somehow refuse to learn our lesson. Dr. Zubrin brought up a group of intellectuals called the Club of Rome.
The Club of Rome was this very elite group that published a study in 1972 called The Limits to Growth. And they were very prestigious both because of who they were. They were all very, very high up people in corporations and aristocracy and everything. And also because they had a computer, which nobody else had. And with the computer, they projected we were going to run out of everything by around the year 2000. That is, if you took the amount of known oil reserves and the rate we were using oil, it would run out in 1992, and the copper would run out in 1996, and zinc in 2001, and so forth. And there it was, simple math, and it's done by a computer, so there was no arithmetic mistakes, and only cretins from the Chamber of Commerce would believe other than that we were running out of everything, okay? Of course, all these predictions turned out to be radically false, and we have more of everything now than we did then, okay? We have much bigger oil reserves now than we had in 1972, even when compared to the rate at which we're using oil. And same with all these other materials, because the technology advances. A few years ago, a number of the same people who published The Limits of Growth published another book called something like The Limits to Growth Revisited. And this was the amazing thing about this book. They said, well, yeah, I guess none of our predictions turned out to happen, but we were fundamentally right. We're fundamentally right because we have to be right. We have to be running out of stuff. Yes, okay, we got some things wrong. We didn't expect them to discover this and discover that here or there, but now we're right. This idea is so pathological and commanding in its nature that people insist that they were right even when they were shown to be completely wrong.
What it sounds like to me is a religious idea.
It is, and I call it anti-humanism.
So what do you do with this information? You reject anti-humanism. You believe that people are not only good, but essential. We need more people making new discoveries, inventing new technologies that push all of us forward. And I know we're on a tangent here. So what does all of this have to do with Mars? Well, Mars is the embodiment of humanism. Mars is the embodiment of the idea that we can do anything, that we can take a rock in space and bring it to life. And Zubrin would argue here it is imperative that we prove this. Because if we don't, the anti-humanist philosophy will proliferate, and inevitably, we will be consumed by that violent clash of all against all, of war.
We're not in danger of running out of resources. We're in danger from people who think we are running out of resources.
Right.
We're not in danger from overpopulation. We're in danger from people who think there are too many people. Going to Mars is the clearest and most blatant demonstration of the non-finitude of human reach. In other words, as soon as you say we are not confined to the Earth, then this entire thesis of ultimately things are limited is blown away. You say, okay, look, bioengineering shows that we can create crops that are much more productive than existing crops, and they can grow in places that they can't grow now. And that's an expansion of resources. But then they always come back and say, okay, sure, you've tripled the crop yield, but now it's finite. The process of technological progress is the proof in the fourth dimension that our resources are unlimited. The reach into space is unique in that it shows it in the three spatial dimensions that it's unlimited. To understand the reality of progress, you have to know history. Whereas to understand the expansion of humanity into space, making our resources unlimited, you can see it.
All right, so we're going to Mars. Last week, we launched our first mission there with technology that's already been created, a mission that is fully within our grasp today. And then what do we do? Well, then we have to build a new world. The process of colonizing, terraforming, and ultimately civilizing Mars is an alchemical process, right? It isn't gold from stone, at least not literally, yet. But in a very real sense, we're going to be transforming an inhospitable world into something living, and with it then, the philosophical piece, from one false conception of humanity's potential to what we hope will be the final proof of the truth. We're capable of anything. But how do you build a new world? Where do you even start?
You know, you want to have a kind of eschatological, transformative view of the future.
I talked to Trey Stevens, a partner here at Founders Fund, at length about this question of how do you tackle large, complex problems? This is something he's worked on for most of his career. There is this idea out here in Silicon Valley that you can iterate to just about anything. You start with some very small piece of code, solving some very small problem. You gain some traction, you build on it, and from that, you build a massive company. But while this does seem to work for some things, especially things in the consumer space, you can't iterate to a rocket ship. So the kind of problems that SpaceX is tackling, the kind of problems that the US government tackled, from the Apollo program to the Manhattan Project, and the kind of massive program that Palantir built, where Trey worked before Founders Fund. In all of these cases, you start with an incredibly ambitious endgame, and the entire goal collapses if even one of the millions of steps leading up to it fails. There is no kind of victory here. There is no pivot to a different business model. You either build a new world that can host an entirely new branch of human civilization, or you don't. There is no middle ground here. Now, I know we can't talk too much about what you're working on right now separately from Founders Fund, but you have come previously from Palantir, which is a company that did have a super long-term plan. And now you're working on a company that is similar in that it kind of doesn't work unless it works. Your first product is a big, complicated thing. There's no small version of it. There's no real minimum viable product. How do you even begin to think about planning towards something that is so big that maybe it doesn't exist for another 5 or 10 years?
The first thing is having a plan is better than not having a plan. Everything is kind of driven from your core passion. If you aren't so obsessed with correcting something that you're willing to abandon everything else you're doing in life to work on it, that's going to lead to these very indeterminate switching outcomes. But if you're super passionate about achieving this kind of audacious goal, laying out a plan to get there gives you guidance for where there are acceptable pivots and what pivots would be entirely unacceptable. Speaking specifically about the defense space, I do think this plays out very deeply, where incrementalism is actually the only way people know to get anything done. In the mid-90s, we started working on the F-35, the Joint Strike Fighter program. Here we are 23 years later, and the plane is still not in a fully operational status. The whole program has been beleaguered by cost overruns, schedule delays, testing and evaluation problems. And then you also have, you know, the Ford-class aircraft carrier. If you listen to like what was said at the christening, it was like, it's the biggest. We have the most people, the most planes. No one talks about capability because we haven't actually developed any new capability. We're not able to do things now that we couldn't do before in any real meaningful way. It's just incremental. You know, you see this from the people that built it, who are called systems integrators, not systems creators, systems integrators. And you see this in the framing of the program itself. It's called the fifth generation fighter. Like, it's admittedly saying we are one generation better than the last generation. Whereas if you had asked someone, what does warfare 25, 50, 100 years from now look like? They're not going to say, well, it looks like the sixth generation fighter. It's like, no, it's completely different. It's probably unmanned. It probably has totally different capabilities. Maybe it's a swarm capability. Maybe it's not a fighter aircraft that costs hundreds of millions of dollars to produce. So we're kind of stuck in this incremental cycle for building all of the big important things in our military. You know, the way that I tend to look at the way that people view the world is this idea of protological versus eschatological. Protological means going back to creation and moving forward. Eschatological is the opposite. It's like projecting infinitely into the future and then working back. And, you know, so often this destructive view of technology basically says that mankind is moving back protologically towards the starting point. So like the best thing that humanity could do is preserve and conserve, right? It's like we should burn less fuel. We should reduce our population size. We should be more conservative with how we expend resources. And then the eschatological view is the one that says there's some better point in the future and we need to move towards that future. But that future is real and determined. Even if you knew exactly what it looked like, you would still have to work towards that because it can't just magically happen. All of our time and effort is most valuable when working towards transformation. If you know the outcome that you're seeking to reach, it is much easier to plan how you're going to get there and not be swayed by the winds of change. Because in the modern world, having a big goal is kind of looked down on as being stubborn and inflexible. And there's this incredible mimetic desire that we have as human beings to do the thing that people tell us is the right thing to do. And if you look at any of the people that accomplished these really huge goals, they were being bombarded throughout the entire development of that thing into people telling them that it was wrong, it was too capital intensive, the world wasn't ready for it, or there wasn't a customer base, or whatever it might be. The more protological you are, the more likely you are to be destructive. The more eschatological you are, the more likely you are to say, like, the eventual outcome is only determined if we work towards it.
Mars is important to a lot of people for a lot of different reasons. For some, it's to preserve life. For others, it's to prove that life is worth preserving. For some people, Mars is the frontier, and we need a frontier to challenge us to realize our full potential. For some, it's just our destiny. At night, we gaze up at the stars, and we feel some sense that that is where we belong. For the people who look to the human being as itself the problem, I don't think there's much we can say. It becomes impossible to argue for Mars when you don't believe that people are good. The argument for Mars as a new world for people dies as soon as you admit you don't care about people. But I think for the rest of us, the vision of another blue-green marble in the solar system, our closest neighbor, now our second home, big oceans and puffy white clouds, whole continents turn green. The thought of this seems obviously good. The thought of this for me seems to be obviously what we're meant for. But bringing it to life and building, in a sense, a world from scratch, designing the material structure of that world and seeding that world with a new branch of human civilization, this is an optimistic goal. But it's a crazy goal. What makes you think we're going to accomplish it? Do we have a plan? Does anyone, with any kind of power? The most recent word from the government is we're going to the moon. Why are we going back to the moon? We have had the technology to go to Mars since at least the 70s. The truth is, America's answer to the question of Mars is an indeterminate, if happy, if positive, shrug of the shoulders. We believe it's just going to happen, but it's not, because nothing on this scale just happens. Last week, we took our first step, our initial mission to Mars. We looked at NASA's work and the work being done at SpaceX, and we talked about the likely course our rockets will be taking in the years to come. Next week, let's look at the advanced propulsion systems. Let's check out nuclear and antimatter rockets. And then, in the weeks to come, what will our first astronauts do on Mars? What kind of colony will we build? And then, from there, what kind of city? How are we going to warm the surface of the planet and seed it with life? And what about radiation, the lower gravity, and that great atmospheric challenge, a vulnerability to solar wind that has already stripped Mars bare? Well, sit tight. We have a few ideas and a plan. I'm Mike Solana, and this is Anatomy of Next. New World.